Film historian Janine Basinger's latest book, I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage and the Movies, examines the role of married life in film, from Nick and Nora and Fred and Ginger and Bob, Carol, Ted and Alice, up to the families of the 21st century. Ms. Basinger is chair of film studies at Wesleyan University and the author of 9 other books on film. The latest is published by Knopp. I'm very pleased it has brought her back to our show. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Should we assume that the way marriage has been depicted in movies going all the way back to The Silence reflects what Americans thought about marriage at the time, or what movies thought about marriage?
Well, both. I mean, because movies had to partly reflect what people thought, and then people started thinking whatever Hollywood thought. So, you know, it's one of those relationships that, you know, chicken-egg deals. But I would say yes and yes.
You write that marriage movies have generally been sold as stories about romance. Does saying they're about marriage suggest that the movie might be too boring?
Well, yeah, I think Hollywood was always concerned about a happy marriage story because obviously that might be boring. I mean, a happy marriage presumably just chugs along, you know, and not much happens and it's all sweet and nice and there's no event. So of course, in order to make a marriage story, they were going to have to break the marriage or hurt it or damage it or destroy it. And then they weren't sure if that would be something married people or ordinary people would want to see either.
Well, they could have the marriage story as a background to something else that's going on.
And that would not be a marriage movie then. You see, marriages are all over the movies in some way, but if the story is only about a marriage, then you have a kind of no story arc situation.
So the story arc that developed at least initially was peace, discord, and restoration of bliss. And you say the formula was pioneered by Cecil B. DeMille?
I think he's really the father of the marriage movie. Not that he made the first ones or the only ones, but he was the one who knew how to take it to the bank. He knew how to glamorize it, how to make it sexy, usually about adultery, and then put it back together. He was a master at taking it apart and putting it back together.
And going back to The Silence, you say they were bipolar about marriage.
Well, usually, I mean, it's not good to oversimplify something as wonderful as silent movies and subtle and terrific as they were, but usually a marriage was either comedy with people bopping each other over the head with rolling pins, or it was serious and there was really something bad happening.
But this is before the code, so
yes.
Were they circumspect about
dealing with
marriage?
Well, they were quite unafraid of adultery. They were quite unafraid of sex, but they were afraid of censors, local censors, and they were concerned about audience response. So it's the DeMille solution. Show all the sin you want and then say, but that's naughty and bad.
And present it as a cautionary
tale.
His film, The Cheat, was made in 1915. It was so popular, they actually made it twice?
They made it twice more. It seemed to be a story that for some reason appealed. It's an adulterous woman who gets branded by the man she has an affair with because she cheats him. She's going to have an affair, but she really doesn't. So this is the ultimate caution.
Pretty awful price to pay.
You bet.
Were straying men punished that brutally?
Well, straying men were punished with more of a slap on the wrist, and then they went back home and everything was fixed up. There was always the double standard, and a man straying seemed to be more nature's way than a woman straying.
What about D.W. Griffith? Did he get involved in this? After all, he's probably the father of American cinema.
Yes, one of his films about marriage that I especially liked is called, appropriately, The Battle of the Sexes. And it's a wonderful story, really, quite a good film, of a man who strayed, a happy, happy family man, played by Gene Hirschholt. But then he spots the brazen blonde down the hall and just falls into sin and then loses everything and has to get it back together with his wife. And, you know, it's a traditional story, but beautifully done by D.W. Griffith.
Well, it is later. It's 1928, just before sound comes in.
So it's already getting to more sophistication in that regard.
But the film industry was already avoiding marriage as a topic because people were looking for something more escapist?
I think that what Hollywood felt was that this story, the story of marriage, is the story the audience knows better than we do. And it's also...
Especially in Hollywood.
Exactly. And so it's also the story they're living. So when they go to the movies, if they have a choice of, you know, do you want a Western? Do you want a crime? Do you want whatever? Or do you want a story about marriage? That chances are they would rather have something they didn't know. So they started to feel more iffy about the form.
Although we have a lot of... interesting marriages in movies. Nick and Nora Charles.
Yes, Nick and Nora.
And they do all the stuff. Well, right. And they have a happy marriage, but they bicker. And
But they aren't domestic, are they? Nobody's rustling.
They're always wearing evening clothes.
Exactly. They're like on an eternal date. I mean, they have the marriage we all thought we were going to get. You know, it's a big lifelong date. And you're dating, you're in love, it's romantic, you go out for dinner, you have ritzy clothes, you have martinis and a dog. And so that's the marriage, everybody. But it's not really domesticity. They're more a romance inside a detective movie.
What about the films that suggest a marriage in their titles? Barclays of Broadway, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Mr. and Mrs. Bridge.
Well, these are actually, in the case of Mr. and Mrs. Bridge and Mr. and Mrs. Smith, they are about marriages. The Barclays, a little bit about marriage, but more about dancing. But it's not that there aren't movies about marriage, but there are fewer of them than you think because domesticity wasn't as interesting as people thought.
And then things are complicated by the enactment of the Production Code of 1934, which dictates that the sanctity of the institution of marriage be upheld.
Once that came in, people really had to stop and think about it because it really said overtly, be respectful of marriage. Marriage is a primary American institution. If you're going to break it apart, if you're going to have it be adulterized, you need to think about decency, about social attitudes.
The code said adultery must not be justified or presented attractively.
Exactly.
But then they also showed marriage as being really sexless. Married couples always were relegated to separate beds. And I remember noticing when I was a kid that when a husband sat on his wife's bed, he had to have one foot on the floor.
As indeed he did, because it might be naughty if he didn't. Well, you know, the thing is, it presented a world of sort of a pseudo-marriage in that regard. I mean, it was always a problem to tell a marriage story because of some of these restrictions. And, you know, it's easy then, however, on the other hand, to show that marriage maybe wasn't very interesting or very exciting. A marriage with a man keeping his foot on the floor might not be any fun.
My guest is Jeanine Basinger, Chair of Film Studies at Wesleyan University and the curator of the cinema archives there. Her latest book, this is your 10th?
Yes.
Is I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies. Well, of course, along with marriage comes divorce. How has divorce been treated in films over the years?
Interestingly, the majority of marriage movies are really divorce movies. And in fact, they created the format of flashback for a marriage movie where it begins in the divorce court and then you see the marriage and you come back to the divorce court where it can be resolved positively. So divorce, which was also socially unacceptable, was used as a device to sort of, you know, jazz up the marriage story, the threat of divorce.
Was DeMille's Why Change Your Wife, which is made in 1920, the first film that was specifically about divorce?
Well, I wouldn't want to say the first. I'm always wary of that one because who knows what's out there that we don't know. There had been divorce stories before, but DeMille popularized the idea of divorce as a social threat.
Now, I recently saw The Awful Truth.
Yes.
On Turner Classic Movies, a wonderful
great
film.
Yes.
And that film starts off with Cary Grant returning from what seems to have been a time when he had been adulterous, yet it never becomes an issue. But it also reminded me of something else. Ralph Bellamy always seemed to be playing the guy that the wife planned to marry after the divorce.
Yes, Ralph Bellamy is always relegated to the junk heap of possible husbands. If you run out of everybody else, if all the Cary Grants disappear, you then marry Ralph Bellamy. But it is definitely true that The Awful Truth begins with a kind of low-key indication that he has been off having affairs and playing around with other women.
And yet he's never punished for it, and we root for him to get his marriage back together.
Right. That's because we don't have to deal with it overtly in our faces. And, you know, we have a tendency to be able to ignore those things, especially when it's Cary Grant.
Well, also, that film, like many of the other films, had a lot of witty dialogue, a lot of bantering mm-hmm. and bickering. And so we kind of forget that it's really about some guy who was cheating on his wife.
We totally do. And that's called great structure and smart screenwriting and the ability to deny what's in front of us, which is really key to the understanding of the Hollywood film. It's also, they treat a divorce, they do get divorced, but the rest of the movie is a romantic comedy. They have to fall in love all over again. They romp around. It's very funny.
It doesn't hurt that Irene Dunne is the wife.
Not at all. It doesn't hurt that Asta plays the dog. I mean, it's all wonderful. Even Ralph Bellamy is fabulous. And so, you know, you have the sense there of how you can just ditch marriage and tell a romantic comedy. And it's interesting that this particular romance is grounded in a problem that would be horrible if we actually looked at it.
Can we look at the Laurel and Hardy movies as marriage movies?
I do. I decided that I sat watching movie after movie after movie. And of course, it didn't occur to me to turn to Laurel and Hardy, but I came across a Laurel and Hardy, of course, on Turner Classic, God bless them. And it was Way Out West, and I saw them doing their little dance together. And it suddenly occurred to me, these two people work harmoniously together. They bicker, they quarrel, they get mad, but let something threaten them and they pull together. And I suddenly thought, you know, this is marital. They're very much in each other's wavelengths, and I thought they were a great marriage.
So by extension, Abbott and Costello and
no, they're mad at each other.
Martin and Lewis are marriages as well?
They're getting a divorce.
Well, Abbott and Costello, there's a problem with communication.
Yes, exactly.
Who's on first?
Well, that's it. I mean, there you have it. Their comedy is grounded in the lack of communication, and also they are they're much more, there's anger there between them. It's different.
And in the case of Martin and Lewis, they did get the divorce.
They did.
There were these love teams that were developed. We mm-hmm. think of Astaire and Rogers, of course, Greer Garson, Walter Pidgeon, mm-hmm. Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn, Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they really were a couple off screen. Was it a matter of somebody deciding in the studios that these couples had chemistry?
I think it was a matter of somebody in the audience deciding that they had chemistry and speaking with their dollars by going to the box office and having the studio pick up on it. Astaire and Rogers were never intended to be a team. They were paired in Flying Down to Rio, but the public loved them together and wanted to see more. I think when the public felt a couple was a couple, they wrote in and indicated it, and the box office reflected it, and Hollywood then officially made them a couple.
There are seven issues, you say, that threaten marital bliss in the movies: money, infidelity, in-laws, kids, incompatibility, class differences, addiction, and murder.
Yes.
And that would still hold true today.
Definitely. And it holds true internationally. I went to look at films from other countries about marriage thinking, you know, how is this? Do they have a different set? No, they don't. And interestingly, those are the basics. My favorite, of course, being murder. Who would think, I mean, of the people you know who are married, is murder on the list? And yet in the movies, it definitely is.
Well, it also becomes a major subject for filmmakers like Ingmar Bergman.
Right.
Yasujiro Ozu.
Right.
More recently, there was this incredible film from Iran called The Separation.
A great film.
But that's really about a couple that is divorcing.
It's about two couples, and each of them has deep marital problems. One is divorcing and the other is strangely disconnected in some way. But you would expect there to be something cultural there that you would think, but there isn't. We could recognize those as the same kinds of problems.
Could we call the women's pictures of that came out after World War II marriage films? The one I'm thinking about, of course, is a 1939 film, The Women, George Cukor's film, in which there are no men, and yet marriage is discussed constantly.
Yeah, well, who needs men for marriage, you know? I mean, if it's a woman's film, they don't need men. But I do call it a marriage movie of a type because the entire subject of that film is marriage, but there are no men in it. It's an interesting thing.
A television kind of took over.
Yes.
With The Honeymooners, I Love Lucy, Ossie and Harriet,
yes.
Father Knows Best. Mm-hmm. Those were all pretty much ideal marriages.
Well, you know,
except The Honeymooners, but even The Honeymooners is an ideal marriage.
It's a kind of ideal marriage if, you know, you like threatening one another. The interesting thing is that television became an ideal format for telling a marriage story because it's episode to episode to episode. It doesn't need a story arc. Film had to turn what was a sort of merry-go-round ride into a roller coaster ride, and television can just have a marriage going episode to episode, so it worked well.
So when did it change in the movies with Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice?
Well, one of the things that started to change with Two for the Road, where you really don't have the kind of closure that reassures you. But yes, you begin to see the change, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, that society isn't valuing marriage in the same way. It isn't telling you you need to be married, you need to be true. It isn't saying the same thing anymore.
More recent films, The Kids Are All Right and This Is 40.
Yes.
This Is 40 is kind of like a throwback, isn't it?
Well, it's a throwaway for me. I found that a very strange. As a married person, I couldn't relate to that movie. But I think The Kids Are All Right is an excellent example.
Which is about a same-sex marriage.
Right. But yet the story format is a familiar one. It's the adultery issue and, you know, conflicts over children.
Janine Basinger's latest book about film is I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies. It is published by Knopf. And I want to thank you for being on our show again today.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.